C-167. Number 7A.
Now we come to principle, and we want to see how that tone of principle evolves through the four chapters. The fourth prayer in the chapter on prayer was a subject that is very easy for every student that approaches the subject of God to fulfill. It has to do with obedience to our conviction. It has to do with an honesty to our conviction, namely that we gear everything that which we do and think and have into the one and the same channel towards the divine principle. So that it asks here that our thoughts, our actions, our life, our motive, our aims, all are, so to say, subject to the service of principle, that they don't contradict each other. A principle is that where everything is gathered together into a harmonious network, into a harmonious system, so that every idea, every part serves the whole, the central principle. So here we find a sense that we have to get rid of our personal sense so that only the principled attitude is reigning within us, that the principled attitude is reigning our thoughts, our action, our life, our motive, our aims, everything that we do. So that there is a harmonious relationship being established within ourselves. That gives us an answer that therefore we have to get free of trying to fool ourselves by trying to be a hypocrite, for instance, but to be honest about what we think and do. It frees us from self-justification. We want to be justified before God, before principle, and it frees us from the mere professions that we make in our prayer and those vain repetitions of words. So we get a deep sense of having a principled attitude. I think this is the prayer of principle. If we have a principled attitude, then in Atonement and Eucharist we see that we are one with principle. If we have a principled attitude, we reflect really principle, and therefore within ourselves then the idea of principle can work that what principle wants to work out within us. We get the touch of the Christ working within us, which says that if we are obedient to that principle, that then that endows us, it comes to us as spiritual power, as the spiritual power of principle, which says that God is the power in the messianic work, that not our will or our personal abilities is really the savior in us, that we cannot really solve problem through our own will and our own doings, but that we have to let the Christ idea work within ourselves so that the divinity of Christ is made manifest in the humanity of within us. So through a principled attitude in prayer, we open up our consciousness, our whole mentality, so that the Christ idea can work within us and can work out that which principle has in store for us, that principle has in view for us. That's the point where we begin to feel that really the divine must overcoming the human at every point, and that it can reach, so to say, in that system to every part of the system and can touch every part of the system, see if that every part of the system is in accordance with principle or if it's not in accordance to principle. And if it's not in accordance to principle, then the divine can overcome the human at that point. It can overturn and overturn until the right sense, the principle sense, is established within us. So this is Atonement and Eucharist, which lets in that Christ working within ourselves, which naturally then has an outcome. Christianity is always the outcome. We come to the chapter on marriage, and the outcome there is actually that when the divine has overcome the human at every point, that then we are a Christian scientist. She takes up that point that only a Christian scientist can have a harmonious life. That only then, when everything is always in accord with principle, and that we put personal sense aside, as in prayer, and everything is accord with principle, that then we are Christian scientists, which alone establishes harmony in human relationships. We get here Christianity as a relationship between all men, in mankind, and says that can only be established really by everybody subjugating himself, subordinating himself to the one principle, and not to try really to put one's own personal view and personal attitude into the forefront. That brings us to the fourth chapter on spiritualism, and we remember in the first part of spiritualism we had that anomaly that Mrs. Eddy doesn't give a subject on principle, so that she leaves it out. But she takes it up in the second part very much, which says, well, if you have attained an impersonal attitude within yourself in marriage, and I have an attitude of being a scientist going out always from principle, then in the chapter on spiritualism, that second part shows that from that point of principle, we really can interpret the universe right. And you get the sense suddenly that we can interpret everything from the point of view of principle. She calls it divine mind reading. Divine mind reading, which has one aim in view, namely to read only ideas and not to read evil. Mind reading does not even read directly human thought and human belief. It only knows ideas, and therefore we come here to that point of science where it says what we have to know is actually the realm of ideas, and that must be interpreted through the divine principle according to the categories of being. This is in contrast to mortal mind reading, which reads mortal thought, which reads really human thought, but which can never read reality. So mortal mind reading can never interpret reality, can never interpret the true universe. Only when we go out from the divine mind, we can see that we have to deal with a universe of ideas. So at that point, really, we free ourselves from that belief that the human mind should know everything, that the human mind should be aware of everything, that the human mind should be able to read the past, the present, and the future, that the human mind really should be able to read present and absent thought. All that falls to the ground when we lift thought up to principle. So it is necessary first in marriage to see that we are a scientist and only want really to view the universe as a scientist. If we do that, then in the chapter on spiritualism, we go out from principle, interpret the universe from the point of view of that principle, and interpret only a universe of ideas. And in order to do that, the third part says, therefore, you have to be careful that you always go out from principle in a deductive way. You have to deduce from principle in order to arrive at the right conclusion. You cannot arrive at the right conclusion by going out from the phenomena, but you have to go out from principle and see that only that can interpret the right thing. So she gives here the method of deduction from principle to idea. And in that way, finishes the whole subject of the approach to God to the standpoint of principle. Again, just pinpointing those four chapters, we go out first from honesty with ourselves. Honesty with ourselves that says, does everything agree with each other, what we think and do and read? Do the words and our acts agree? Do the acts and the words agree with our life? Does our life agree with our aim in life, with our motives in life? Is that all in agreement? If it is in agreement, then it is bound together into a harmonious system. If that is bound together in a harmonious system, that principle can work through that harmonious system within ourselves. Then the divine can overcome the human at every point. It can find out everything within ourselves that needs correction. And so principle demands that correction, will correct everything that is not in accordance with the divine. So the divine must embrace the human, but see that the human is overcome to the point where it is divine, which leads us as a result to the point where we are no more a person, we don't consider us as a person, we see that everything is impersonal, and therefore everything is a subject to a principle. We have become a scientist, and as a scientist we have a universe of harmony. That's a demonstration of it. How does that universe of harmony really look like? What is it? We don't know yet how it looks like, that universe of harmony. But we can know it, and I go to the first chapter, we can know it through divine mind reading. That reads really the universe of ideas. On the reading that universe of ideas, the third part shows it must be through the deductive way from principle to idea. That's the tone of principle here. And so we have reached through the first four chapters really the approach to God in order to take really the true standpoint of principle, so that then in the next chapter on animal magnetism, it can say, that principle now is working out everywhere the maximum of good. That principle cannot do anything but work out the maximum of good. So that there is no working of the Antichrist or of animal magnetism. But that belongs then already to the impact of the Christ on a human situation. Yes. Then we go to life. And we take up the fifth subject in each chapter, and what do you see here in life? Again, prayer seems to be the cornerstone, lays the foundation on which we have to stand, or else everything that follows afterwards has no basis. Without that, we build on sand. And I always like to show that and say, think of prayer as always, in everything we do, as our starting point. It's no use to try to demonstrate the 12th chapter on healing without a prayerful attitude. That doesn't work. We can study that 12th chapter as long as we like and read it as often as we like. Without a prayerful attitude within ourselves, that 12th chapter of healing is just a statement, just words. But it has not the living power that it should have and that it has if it is based within ourselves on a prayerful attitude. With a prayerful attitude, we study that 12th chapter. Just to show, this is a side note actually that I give here, just to show that everything hinges together in the textbook, that no chapter can stand alone in the textbook, that each chapter presupposes really that the preceding chapters have been assimilated spiritually, and that that alone, again, is the seed for the succeeding chapters. All right. I started out with life in prayer, and the subject there is, as we remember, a very important point, because we are easily fooled by prayer, because it says that petitions bring to the petitioner actually only the results of the petitioner's own beliefs. Whatever we believe in has an effect. We, in the realm of belief, we have cause and effect. In the realm of belief, we have phenomena that are being brought about through the belief structure in our consciousness. So if there are phenomena that appear, then we have to be careful that we don't judge from the phenomena, but that we judge from the noumenon. You see, through the fourth subject of principle, as we have taken it, we have come at the end of chapter 4 to the point where it was said, now we interpret from really God, from the principle to idea. So now the fifth says, now if you do that, then you pray aright. Go to the source of everything. Always go back to God in your prayer. Go back and see that what we are entertaining in our prayer has its source in life, in the well of life, in the source of life. Else, if you have your source in belief, you only reap in experience the phenomena of belief, the experience of belief, a belief universe, a belief life, so to say. But life itself says that life is the only source, the only well that can bring forth something. Principle says, I'm the right standpoint from which to interpret, but life says, I'm the well of life, I'm the source of life. Out of me flows everything, and therefore the experience we make comes from the source of life. Experience is a life attitude, is a life phenomena. So in here, a prayer says, go with all what you have in yourself, with all your understanding you have within yourself, with all your sincerity that you have within yourself, with all your devotion, go to the source. Go out from life and see that life is pouring forth everything, that life is pouring forth more than what we can accept. So this is the very first cornerstone for life, that going to the source. If we go to that source, then a dominant Eucharist can really then come along and says, all right, that source is overflooding your whole being. That comes from God to you, that's a Christ message, that life comes to you flooding your consciousness and your experience. It comes in the fullness of life. But that means that you can't go against life. And so a dominant Eucharist will overturn everything that goes against life. Therefore, it demands that we lay down a mortal sense of life, a limited sense of life, an erroneous sense of life, a corporeal sense of life, a social sense of life, a business sense of life, a financial sense of life, whatever life we call it, that you have to lay down. In other words, that is not your source. That source is a false source and must be replaced by the new life, by that one life, where we see that from life flows all that is good, all that is constructive. It may find resistance within us, and if it finds resistance within us and the world, that's only reasonable, that's only logical, because the old does not want to give itself up. And therefore, we experience there trials, tribulation, persecution, misunderstanding, ridicule, etc. So that's the whole tone of Atonement and Eucharist, which says that life, if we love life, and if we love that life as the only life, then we also are willing to give up a false sense of life, a temporal sense of life. We all are under that curse, I think I can say that, under that curse, that we think in terms of 80 years or so about life, beginning with birth, ending with death, and that has to be overcome. It has to be overcome not by saying there is life after death, but by seeing that there was life before birth, and that life is without time or space a concept, free of time and space. So this is what Christ is doing with us, that he takes away from us a limited sense of life and asks us to accept really the infinite concept of life. If we do that in some measure, then we come to marriage. If we do that in some measure and see the dignity of life, the nobility of life, the more cultured sense of life, then that attitude can bring forth a better progeny. There we have that sense, how can we improve the human species? It is by having those refined qualities of life, those cultured sense of life, that exalted sense of life, that the good, she says, must have ascendancy over evil in our life. That's culture. That's dignity. That's nobility. So that the grossness of a mortal life is overcome and is replaced by that cultured sense of life. This brings forth a better human species, better children. Better children, healthier children, more intelligent children, more obedient children, that are under the impulse of the divine principle. That's life at that point. Well, if we can see that it is actually through that one source of life to which we go in prayer, which in Atonement and Eucharist gives us a new sense of life, that new sense of life slowly is taking the place of the old sense of life, and therefore in marriage gives us a better sense of progeny and of human species, of living or bodies, that then really in the fourth chapter one begins to see that there is only one life and that there is not many lives, that there is only one life, unlimited life. And that is shown there by showing that on this basis Jesus could resurrect Lazarus by admitting to himself that Lazarus never lived in a body, that life never has died into a body, and therefore Lazarus could not die out of the body, so that there is only one life, and that life really is without beginning, without end. That life is the life before birth, before death. It's a life that is independent on birth and death, absolutely independent of death. There's only one life. You can see that really the fourth chapter always brings out that the synonymous term is the one and only reality. We had in the fourth chapter seeing that actually only mind and mind's ideas constitute reality. Then in spirit, that only spirit as the only reality exists. Then in soul, that the only immortality is soul, the immortality of soul. That in principle, the only principle is really God interpreting itself. And here in life, it shows there is only one life. And on that basis, Jesus could resurrect Lazarus. On that basis, we can overcome birth and we can overcome death. Or we could say, on this basis we see that we have never been born and therefore never have to die, because life is eternal. Before Abraham was, life is. And even that which is called death is just an opportunity, as she says, for us to be removed into the verities of life. Only if we don't grow spiritually, she says, we go from one dream through death to another dream. But that is not the only possibility, she also said, or to the verities of life. That in the measure that we have cultured ourselves in the consciousness that there is only one life, that life knows no birth, no decay, no death, that ushers us into the verities of life and not into another dream existence. Which then, further, she shows that in the second part, that if we have that attitude of life, that is the one life, that life is actually the father of the whole universe, that with that life we can project always the constructive ideas, the newness of life into the universe. Just as mortal beliefs project constantly false phenomena into the world of beliefs. So that life itself, the divine life, has within itself that fatherhood sense that says, I can project into the universe only ideas. Then I'm the father to the universe. That's our job, actually, our mission, our vocation in this world, that we consider ourselves as a well of life. As a Christian Scientist, in principle, at the point of life, we are a well of life, projecting only constructive, positive ideas into every situation, no matter if that situation looks bad, if that situation is inimical to us, no matter what the situation is, we have to use that grace of God that only projects and projects and projects and projects that which is from the well of life. We have not to judge a situation as good and evil. We only have to project from our well of life really the constructive ideas. And that shows itself then in the third part as that healing aspect of divine mind reading, that with that attitude of projecting only ideas into the universe, we can never do harm. Even if it's not received well, even if it's opposed, that doesn't matter. We can only do good. That's in the third part and shows the practice of divine mind reading, that divine mind reading can never, like mortal mind reading, do harm, but only good.